Chop Shop, now playing in theaters, in a theater near you, possibly even. Joe Carnahan, does this guy sleep? Because it's the second Joe Carnahan, Frank Grillo joint that we're talking about this year. Right. We talked about, of course, about Boss Level a few months ago. Now we're back with Cop Shop. and I'm saying that kind of dismissively. I don't think I've ever seen had a director who's done two movies in the course of a year that are in danger of going onto my top best of the year list. But that might be the case with Mr. Carnahan.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe he's found his new muse in Frank Grillo. I was just and great. I mean, I'm glad Grillo's getting, you know, more work. I think they started working on The Gray with Liam Neeson. You know, it's a grindhouse kind of throwback to a 70s crime drama, but with a lot of humor. And it's cool to see something so loose and fun, yet still within Carnahan's, you know, gritty, violent wheelhouse.
It's like Super Troopers meets Assault on Precinct 13.
Yeah, I can say that. You can say that, sure.
But... And that's the thing that's so crazy about this. And first, I want to talk about Grillo. I guess the only real disappointment of this movie is the poster, which will be on the intro card of this video.
Right.
Shows it's like stock image of Frank Grillo, where he's got the trademark Frank Grillo hair, which he does not have in this movie.
No. And unless you want to say maybe it's pulled back into that man bun, but it doesn't.
It is, but that's not the Frank Grillo TM hair that we know and love. Gerard Butler almost has that hair action going, so maybe they couldn't have it on set because of union rules or something. But I honestly don't like what they did with his hair in this film.
Neither. It looks kind of fake.
It does look kind of fake. It also looks like really greasy, which is, you know, the look they were going for, but. That's kind of okay, because one of the things that I love about this film is it doesn't truly have a main character. It's a complete ensemble cast, and everybody gets not only just their moment to shine, but they almost take over the film at different parts. And then like a triathlon or something, they just hand, if this is the right analogy, they kind of hand the baton off to the next person to shine. And then it all kind of comes back together in the end.
For sure. As I was watching this, I thought, you know, if this was a B movie in the 90s, this would be like Tom Sizemore and Michael Madsen, you know.
Well, let's pull over the cop car and talk about what is Cop Shop. It's a movie about it all takes place in pretty much a single location, a police station in Nevada, where Frank Grillo's Teddy has been, he's caused himself to be arrested by punching a rookie cop
in front of a casino, right?
A casino where there's like
a wedding,
like a wedding going on outside the casino. And he drives into the wedding and starts like yelling, causing commotion. The cops show up. He starts attacking the cops, gets thrown in a cell. Gerard Butler shows up as Bob, who is also arrested under false pretenses, pretending to be, you know, a drunk just to get thrown in the cell, because it turns out he's there to kill our Teddy. And Teddy is involved in this kind of weird Nevada political intrigue where the attorney general has been assassinated, and he's kind of like it. I almost don't understand what his character did. Mm-hmm. I just know that he messed with the wrong, like, super secret organization, and now they've sent people to kill him.
Yeah, that's all you really need to know.
Right. What now, Alexis Lauder, I want to talk about her for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I know she was in the Watchmen TV show, which I haven't seen. I know she was in something, Black Panther. Was she in Black Panther?
Yep.
Okay, who was she in Black Panther? I only saw the movie once.
I think she was one of the... one of the...
Dora Milaje?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I forgot how to say that. Well, I don't know. I know she had a small role in it, okay. But other than that, Well, she did have this movie. I mean, she was in The Good Lord Bird with the Showtime show with Ethan Hawke. Yeah. And then she was in this movie called Mayhem, which looks really interesting, that came out this year. I don't know how to find it. She actually directed and wrote it.
Yeah, so, I was looking on IMDb. I guess it's a short or something. At first I thought it was the Joe Lynch movie Mayhem. Yeah, yeah. And I was like, no, yeah, I don't remember
no
her.
No way.
But this is the thing. I know she's been in other things, none of which I've seen, because she's a relatively new presence. But mm-hmm. I feel like this was a star-making performance. I could not take my eyes off of her. Plus, she plays one of the baddest, you know, I hate the cliche of the badass female character, but it's like, this is the template that everybody, I think, should follow when casting, when writing and conceiving of this type of character, because she was amazing.
Yeah, and she's just interesting because she starts out her character, she plays her character, she's great in the role, and I think it's just interesting the way her character's written. The screenplay credit is shared by Carnahan and Kurt MacLeod.
It was only written, I think this is like the second thing he's written.
Yeah. But I love, you did briefly talk about the opening, but the opening is just her and her sergeant, played by an uncredited Chad Coleman, are just kind of hanging out. It looks like they were hanging out at a crime scene that didn't really go anywhere. And they're, you know, he's downing a greasy, juicy burger, and she is comically playing with her gun, cowboy style, you know, flipping it, putting in the holster kind of thing. And so you could say, you know, you could see she's into her position, her job. She's taking it seriously, but there's also this comedy element to it, you know, where she's, you know, playing around with the gun. And, you know, throughout, and I like that it opened in this setting. It's big sky country. It's Nevada. It's daylight. And I think if you consider the way the cops are portrayed throughout this movie, you could say, oh, geez, they're all a bunch of lunkheads. You know, they're just, oh, my gosh, you know, they're just idiots, you know, except her, you know. But I thought about it, and I'm like, you know, if you see that opening scene, I would imagine it's one of those situations where typically not much happens out there.
Yeah.
You know? And so this is appropriately titled, I think it's Gun Creek, Nevada.
Yeah.
Like, of course, you know. I don't know if that's an actual place, but it's just a perfect name for a Carnahan neo-70s Western crime drama. And so, you know, it is... it seems like every other cop, even including her sergeant, is just kind of out to lunch, let's say, and kind of clueless and not really on the ball. But she's observant. She's, you know, she's not just, you know, an action, you know, character, but, you know, she's observant. She doesn't suffer any fools. And, you know, she's able to hang with the guys and, you know, also just, you know, do her job really well. I mean, she is in the movie, she's, even though as the movie is described, like IMDb or whatever, she's described as a rookie cop, which is kind of interesting because there's hinted at that she has some kind of like a, you know, say like military background, especially
I think she was an army medic.
Okay, army
which
medic.
They bring up. I don't remember what the scene was, but there was a moment where she was doing something that no rookie cop should. I think she was intubating the guy who had his windpipe crushed
by Teddy.
Right.
No, by Bob.
By Bob.
Yeah.
And the very second I was like, how the hell does this rookie Nevada cop know how to do this? I think the cop that was helping her said, how the hell do you know how to do this?
Yeah.
And she was like, I was an army medic. Hold this.
Right.
So, but that's, you know, for as exploitative and grindhousey as this script is, it's also very, very smart, because I think it knows that the audience knows what kind of movie it's watching. And is like, we're here with you. We're the types of people who appreciate this stuff.
Yeah, there's kind of a balance where it's not just sticking with typical grindhouse stereotypes. I think it's It's knowing that and not making, you know, some winks and nods at that, but also it's being a little smarter with character portrayal and having fun, you know. And the camera is, I didn't mind a lot of the camera placements, even though, like, for some reason, I didn't mind it, because typically a lot of the camera placements that are made here that I've seen in other movies, I would kind of eye roll, like, oh, that's going to play out later. Oh, we're sitting on this, you know, the, you know, Carnahan is DP. They do a good job at establishing placement, you know, as far as the interior of the cop shop. And so, you know, at one point,
it looks like a school library.
It does, doesn't it?
Really strange. Yeah.
I'm curious. I didn't really dig up much on this movie, but I'm really curious as to, you know, where they filmed this and, you know, what it was before they turned it into a cop shop. But yeah, you know, how the camera kind of glides over and we see where, like, you know, the rifles are kept in the police precinct and all that. Oh, that'll play out later, of course, you know. And so, you know, I didn't mind that, just because it is just so interesting. And sometimes it's nice to just let the, you know, it's better than the exposition. So sometimes it's just nice to have the camera just lay things out for you and you get a lay of the land and you're like, okay, now that we know how everything is set up and how these, you know, characters, you know, inhabit this place, let's see what's going to happen here. Yeah.
Very much so. And aside from the Frank Grillo's hair, the one I think other detail that bothered me is in the climax, and we'll stay light on spoilers here, because I think this is something people really should experience for themselves. But the gun locker, as you mentioned, we do go by, like, oh, that's the place where they have the heavy artillery. That is going to become important later. And it does. And what's really disappointing is they make such a big deal of the security of, like, the vaults, and, like, there are doors that you cannot get into in this place. But the armory that's, like, on the second floor, like, literally you just bust it out with the butt of a gun and you can get in to get the heavy weapons. Like, no.
Well, you know, they never anticipated somebody breaking in, or, you know, getting, you know, what, apprehended in order to break in to get out, you know, all that stuff.
But they have they've got this triple decker security vault to get into the holding cells.
Yeah. It's like, how does that work?
I feel like this is like a Nevada town in the Marvel universe where they had to, like, in case they have to hold a super criminal.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, maybe a shield, you know, a holdout or something. It wasn't really well planned out.
I want to ask you about this, because we're talking about camera. This has more to do with lighting and filters. There are a few shots that they were distractingly bad, because they look almost like day for night shots kind of field officer who is out investigating some, you know, shootouts involving feds and possible criminals. We see
at night, nighttime, or
at quote unquote nighttime. It's just this weird dark blue filter that's put on. It doesn't look like they shot this at any time of day that I could recognize. And they do that a little bit at the beginning during the apprehension of the wedding scene. It gets really weird and bluish gray. Like, there's a tint that's been placed on the movie that I couldn't quite reconcile. Did you catch that?
Well, some of the nighttime scenes, at least for me, just seemed a little, darker than usual. I kind of understood maybe where we see Gerard Butler's character in, you know, in when we first kind of meet him, when he's crashing into the other, you know, state trooper cars.
Yeah.
I kind of understood that. I mean, it's kind of low lit because there's not a whole lot of lights around at that point, but I don't know. I didn't maybe pick up that as much as you did. It did seem a lot of times like maybe some of the night scenes were trying to maybe, you know, like, hide certain things, you know, for maybe budget reasons. I don't know.
Well, that's because that's one something that popped in my head is it felt like they were scenes that were filmed to take place during the day. But then when they were putting it together, like, now, timeline wise, we need this to actually be at night. So we'll throw a filter on top of it to make it look
could
darker.
Be. It could be, because most of the I guess it all really takes place in one night. The whole thing and leads into early morning, it seems.
Almost from dusk till dawn, you might say.
In a way, yeah. It's funny you mention that, because I'm like, I could see, like, you know, somebody like Robert Rodriguez in the 90s going nuts with this. But I am glad it's Carnahan. Even maybe somebody like Guy Ritchie or something. But I like how, you know, Carnahan just embraces the, you know, the genre. It's not necessarily gratuitously violent, because a lot of the, gun violence is kind of off camera, and we just see kind of some splatters here and there. I think Carnahan has a good time here with the geography of this, of what, you know, what limitations he has with the geography. And I think it, in that sense, you can rely a lot more on, you know, characterization. It's interesting, the dynamic that plays out between the three main characters, you know, Butler's, Grillo's, and Louder. She is, you know, a very kind of very charismatic, but very intriguing film presence. And I like the way you talk about lighting. I like the way she's lit. A lot of times, like, you know, she's just sitting there in the room in the where these guys are being held in jail, and just the way the light, you know, is on her, you know, you see, you know, her shadows and everything on her features. It's really cool.
There's one kind of series of images we keep revisiting, because at one point she gets wounded.
Yeah.
And she has to spend a lot of time sitting in front of a door because she really can't move. A lot of interesting conversations happen during the stretch of this, as we keep coming back to it. But a lot of it is, you know, she's an African-American actress. She's sweating. There's like these almost like an angelic light to her. And she's, you know, pretty much got a shaved head. She's got very little hair. There's something about the combination of the skin tone, the sweat, the lighting, and that shorn head, and then the welts from the bullets that had come through the door that kind of pop up behind her. They're almost like frame her in a weird, you know, like a old classical painting halo.
Yeah.
I feel like these are images that could be found in a graphic novel or like a fine art print that I just want to take off of my TV and hang up. It is underscored by what the script and what the actress does with her character. You mentioned Guy Ritchie. This is adjacent to Guy Ritchie, but Guy Ritchie doesn't have the dramatic pauses that this movie does, because the action does calm down to have some very serious, heavy conversations. Mm-hmm. There's moments where the characters, that even the ones who are supposed to be, you know, all tough and they're like experienced killers, they get moments of vulnerability that are not as one-dimensional as what we might see in a Ritchie film. And I think that really helps. This movie is like an hour and 48 minutes long, which for just a crazy retro shoot 'em up is, I think, a bit long. But the fact that he takes the time to let us really get to know these characters, even ones that when you first meet them, like, oh, this is a cutout. This is the Terminator. He's just there to you know, blow people up. We learn a bit more about him. Not necessarily, I'm talking about Gerard Butler's character now, Bob, not about his past necessarily, but about his philosophy. And the Teddy has this incredulous conversation where he accuses Bob of being a psychopath. Mm-hmm. And Bob says, I'm not a psychopath, Teddy, I'm a professional. And that's supposed to be kind of a gag. But a few minutes later, we're introduced to Toby Huss's character, Mr. Lamb, who is another hired gun sent into this prison. And we find out what a real psychopath is. And that's when the movie takes its kind of nasty turn. It really becomes this, you know, kind of a precinct invasion movie. I really dug it. That whole stretch reminded me of something out of like Frank Miller's Sin City.
Oh, totally. And I just love, you know, when Bob is first apprehended, there's this moment where he looks, he's at, you know, the front desk. He came up some stairs and he's at the front desk and he looks kind of behind him and you see maybe like a shadow of something, someone coming towards the precinct. And so you get the idea that he knows that there's going to be some other people coming. Or was that Teddy? No, that was...
I don't remember. I remember the shot you're talking about, but I don't remember who it was.
I can't remember if that was Teddy at the front desk or Bob. Might have been Teddy.
There's a lot of people like doing intake in this movie of like coming up to the precinct door and desk and stuff. Yeah.
So I feel like, I think both of them knew that there were other people coming. I mean, the whole reason that Teddy wanted to get apprehended and he felt that he would be safe from Bob in a police precinct is because he was being, you know, chased by Bob. But there's also this feeling that, you know, Bob, although he, you know, played a drunk to get apprehended in order to get to Teddy, I feel like there's this kind of knowledge that he knows that he's not going to be the only one coming after Teddy, but he wanted to be the closest one to get to Teddy. And he did, he was, but you know, like you said, he made that remark that like, there's going to be people coming after you that are crazier than me. You think I'm a psychopath. And it really is just this one guy. And I like the fact that it's not just like a series of assassins coming after Teddy, you know, that would have been crazy.
Carnahan did Smoke and Aces, right? Back in the day.
I think that was Guy Ritchie.
Was that Guy Ritchie?
Yeah.
I thought I saw something about him being associated with it.
Or maybe I could be wrong. I know he did Narc. Mm.
Quick, IMDb.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Smoke and Aces.
A movie I couldn't stand. and I think it's because even though it wasn't a Guy Ritchie film, I feel like that came out during the Guy Ritchie sort of heyday. So it's hey, I'm going to make a Guy Ritchie style movie. And it just didn't work because it was too daffy.
Ryan Reynolds, Ben Affleck. Wow.
Yeah. So the thing is like with the Bob Vittick character, played by Gerard Butler. Yeah. I get the feeling he knew other people were coming unless he could take care of this contract and call it in and basically saying, I already took this guy, you know, off the slate. You don't have to show up. And that was the other kind of thing is the politics and the business of, you know, these hired assassins kind of talking to each other about, well, you've got a contract on your head in Chicago. So what if I did this? You know, it's just all these fun little details, these details that could almost lead to other movies in and of themselves. Films.
Yeah. Almost like this kind of bounty hunter type, you know, assassin thing. We're kind of familiar with bringing a sense of humor to that genre with like maybe Midnight Run. Oh, of course you haven't seen that yet. I'm sorry.
It's on my list.
I know. I love the costume design for this, you know, Anthony Lamb character. He's wearing like a gray members only jacket or something like that. I mean, he just looks like either a pervy pedophile or your kind grandpa. I know that's probably bad to say, but
you know, I was going to say, why did you make a distinction? No,
I don't know. He's the guy that you don't want your kid talking to on the end of the block.
And he shows up with, kiddie balloons too. that's the balance that I think is struck multiple times throughout this film is you've got this wackiness with this nail biting tension because his weapon of choice is, you know, I don't know anything about guns. I'll just call it like an Uzi. It looks
like an Uzi. Yeah.
It looked like, I think they described what it kind of weapon was. It's something I hadn't seen kind of going along with the members only jacket since like the 1980s. This is like the terrorist weapon of choice back in every Chuck Norris movie from like the 80s, but he's kind of bringing it back here. And this long pursuit down a hallway with one of these, you know, intricate doors that we discussed earlier. It's ridiculous, but it's also, I was like, is our hero going to make it out of this situation unscathed?
Right.
Wonderful.
Yeah. There's that moment where she has to enter in a new password in a keypad for a vault door. Yeah, and it's just really, you know, all these steps that she has to take.
But going back to what we were talking about earlier with establishing stuff, mm-hmm. we don't get the boring scene of like the captain taking the rookie around and saying, now here's the door. And if you got to get through it, you got to reset the password. It takes a few minutes. We find that out as she is in the middle of having to do it. Like, oh my God, that's what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it just says, you know, waiting, you know, reset, that kind of thing. And meanwhile,
and it's like confirming and yeah.
Yeah. Meanwhile, there's bullets behind her. Yeah. It's captivating stuff. There's something about this movie though that I felt like there isn't really much. So it's not a mystery. There's really not much mystery to it. It's an intense, you could call it an intense, there's definitely an intensity. There's you could call it a thriller. But it's almost just like you kind of get the idea of, I mean, there's definitely some turns here, but you kind of get the idea of, okay, what's how this is going to play out, except for the very ending. And initially, I wasn't sure how I felt about the ending, and maybe I'm still not sure. But it's just almost like, you know, you're expecting to see like coming next summer, Cop Shop 2 or something, you know, and it's just like, or just like, you know, Rookie Cop, you know, or something like that. You know, it's like, what's going to happen here? Cause it's a bit abrupt, but it's almost kind of fitting for this movie, I guess.
You know, I understand what they were doing with that little coda, but honestly, it feels like a post-credit sequence that I could totally ignore. Mm-hmm. You know, I would be fine with the way that the movie ended before, like at it cuts to black, and I think mm-hmm. they could have just rolled credits on it. It's cute, and again, I don't want to give everything away, but I almost feel like the characters should have understood each other more. The understanding that they grew to,
at least if...
they can't, the two characters who were left at the end of this film, over the course of their night together, they grew to understand things about each other that were sort of unacceptable. Like, okay, you're going to have to go into your corner. I'm going to go into my corner. Otherwise we're going to kill each other.
Right.
And
we can't kill each other if we're going to get out of here, you know?
Right. But then at the end, the one character who is so, I'll say this character is Valerie Young. She is, you know, very much by the book, truth and justice. I'm mm-hmm. going to get the bad guy and all this other stuff. But I feel like she kind of understood there are limits. Whether or not she wants to accept those, she kind of feels like she might have to,
especially because she's wounded. Yeah.
Right. The coda, I think, kind of undoes that and turns her into a superpowered figure in a way that I think is a bit of a betrayal. It felt like a fun, cute little coda, but it goes on for way too long. I'm like, no, this is almost the beginning of another movie that I don't want to watch.
Right. You know, I mean, she's, yeah, at the end, she's almost turning into Furiosa or something.
Yeah.
But and again, I wouldn't mind watching that movie, but it's like, it's almost a jarring coda.
Well, especially because we talk about twists and turns. I keep finding criticisms of this movie where I didn't really think about them while I was watching it, because I really do love this movie.
Yeah.
The first thing I'll say is that there is a little bit too much of, you know, character standing over another character with a gun about to take the shot, and all of a sudden they got shot by someone off screen. Mm-hmm. That happens like seriously 6 times in this movie and probably 4 times in the last 10 minutes. The other thing is, oh, and I completely lost it. Oh, it'll come back to me, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's that kind of thing is repetitive and bound to happen. But again, I still enjoyed it.
Yeah, well, I do remember what I was going to say. There are some character twists and turns, and it involves Frank Grillo's character.
Yeah, and like when, yeah. I don't know if we want to give too much away, but
I know, and I want to talk to you about this, but I'll see if I can dance around it gently. First of all, we get a bit of information about his family, because mm-hmm. much like in Boss Level, he's doing all of this for his family.
I thought about that while watching this. I'm like, okay.
Because the information is delivered in the course of another big lie that is being perpetrated on screen, I immediately thought, okay, that's probably a lie too. Turns out it's not.
Yeah.
Or most probably not. And towards the end of the film, his character takes kind of an unfortunate turn. And I'm so used to watching Frank Grillo be this like good guy anti-hero.
Yeah.
That to see him sort of turn heel, I was like, oh, and I feel like this should have just been another guy coming to the precinct to like the alpha predator to be taken out, because I understand from a story perspective, and I really like Frank Grillo as an actor. I think I was just like bummed out because I'm like, I liked him.
Yeah, I mean, he does play kind of like a scuzzy, you know, kind of, you know, underground, lowlife kind of character, but there is something I like about him. Maybe it's just his charisma, or just this, it's almost this Wile E. Coyote type, you know, feel to him, where he's just like, he won't stop, and he's just, you know, kind of incorrigible.
Well, and possibly this is just because I'm a fan of, you know, his work, and I've seen him in a bunch of movies.
Yeah.
I kind of expect him to play a certain type of character. I'm waiting for the twist of like, well, yeah, he's a scumbag, but he's a lovable scumbag, or he's not really a bad guy. He was sent in there to infiltrate the organization that's now coming after him, or something, like, you know, some kind of a redeeming quality, but that just doesn't turn out to be the case here. And that's not the fault of the actor or the screenwriters. It's just sort of my expectation.
Sure.
I almost feel like they should have gotten another less likable actor.
So yeah, I don't know.
Been a disappointment. I don't know who would have played it.
Stephen Lang or something. Who knows?
Ooh.
You know.
Yeah. Actually, that's great. That's a good call.
Thank you. Yeah. Who knows? Carnahan and Stephen Lang. I think that might be a twist that some people didn't see coming. I'm not saying that I did see it coming, but I wasn't very. I wasn't totally surprised by it. And I think it has to do with the occupation that Bob has and the occupation that Teddy has. One of them has a lot more experience in just taking people out, you know, and the other one is better at running. they're both very capable, but you know, there's, you know, one leans towards the other. There is one character that is only shows up like twice, and it's another, you know, African-American woman that is, I believe she seems to be like maybe with the DA office or something, and she's an investigator, I think. And
I think she is a confusing character, because I thought she was also the one on TV giving a press conference about the murdered DA. And then we also see her in the field delivering some information that we were alluding to earlier. So I'm like, who is she? Is she a politician? Is she a cop?
And that's unfortunate, because not that I want this to be a longer movie, but if this could have been a little bit more developed, and our, you know, kind of rookie hero, Alexis Lauder's character, maybe was aware of this character a little bit more, or just it was established that she knew of her or previously had worked with her, or maybe asked to be assigned in the middle of nowhere in Nevada because of this person. Maybe she wanted to get a distance from her. That would have been at least establishing something that would have been interesting. And, you know, maybe she had done something that put her in the middle of nowhere. And that was a past with this person. But it just seemed like we don't really have enough knowledge or connection with this character, who, again, is only in really two scenes, maybe three. But when she does show up in that last scene, it's just like, okay.
You know, it's the, I feel like this is a character we've seen in like 80s movies that, you know, they show up at the very, they're kind of like the big boss, the person who's in power that is corrupt, and we see them show up at the end with a shotgun, which is pretty much what we get here.
She's been behind it all along, you know, kind of thing.
Right. Listening to you just talk about this, I'm replaying in my head what she was involved in. I feel like you take her character out of the movie and nothing changes story-wise, because there is a shootout that she is tangentially involved in the aftermath of.
Right.
There's also that information that we established was a lie that she gives to another character, which again, I'm stepping around details. But if you remove those, it doesn't affect the story.
No.
At all. It's the shootout is cool, but you didn't need her there in the aftermath with her, you know, kind of team of other cops. It just seems like another layer of stuff. Plus, you wouldn't have had that, you know, the fourth instance in the last 10 minutes of character pointing gun at someone and then they get taken out by someone.
That's almost like a back-to-back beat, you know, beat-to-beat, you know, moment there at the end of happening by, you know, happening to two people. I mean, that would be, you know, one of my, you know, qualms about as far as character treatment. Just seemed like she had kind of like an important role in the story, but there's just not enough information there for us to really, you know, get involved in or really understand.
Yeah, it definitely, because I'm saying that she can be taken out of the film and the movie is not only not negatively affected, but it's actually enhanced by that being excised. I feel like Carnahan and McLeod are smart enough writers based on the rest of the movie. It feels like she was a character who got trimmed and trimmed and trimmed to the point where, well, she's going to be in this movie, but there's a whole 20 page subplot in the script that just got whittled away that we don't know about.
It's a good point. It makes me wonder if what is on the cutting room floor, if anything, you know, and what type of life this script had in a, you know, second and fourth draft or whatever. It's fine the way it is. It's still, you know, very much enjoyable if you're into this kind of thing. and to me, you know, we're getting into a time of year where I'm watching a lot of serious stuff, and so it's nice to have this kind of, you know, breather material. You know, it's a weird time because you're getting into a lot of, you know, we're almost into award season, getting into it, but we're also getting into, like, you know, the fall Halloween, you know, kind of schedule where we're actually getting a Halloween movie, but also, you know, just some of these, you know, kind of random, I'm not gonna, you know, for lack of a better term, kind of, you know, schlocky genre films. But this is definitely a higher caliber of a genre film, primarily because the way it's treated by all involved, but also, you know, the way it's shot. You know, Carnahan definitely has fun with it.
He does, and you know, it's almost unfortunate that
nobody's in theaters.
No, that's not what I was going to say. But the treatment, like, there's a lot of like 70s cop show music that kind of like wow chicka wow chicka wow, and then also the title treatment of Cop Shop, you know, it's very much, hey, this is the vibe we're going for, instead of just having it be the vibe and let us kind of figure out, because that almost, it's sort of the same thing with Boss Level. I hated the first couple of minutes of Boss Level until I figured out what the movie was actually going to be about and its style, because it felt very much like thesis statement. I'm like, you just calm down, you know, show, don't tell. I felt that way with this movie, but those aesthetics, I was fine with after a few minutes. But yeah, I was amazed that I haven't seen Gerard Butler in anything in a while. And I forgot just how much of a presence he is. You know, and he's not playing a guy who's out to, you know, save the world from a meteorite or whatever the hell those movies are that he's been making, or a submarine captain, but he plays a really good
scumbag.
Yeah, I was going to say morally ambiguous. He's not a morally ambiguous character. He's a professional killer.
Yeah.
But he's not one note, and he's quite charming. I do wish that Carney had let him just have his native accent, because he's got that baseball glove face to begin with. But when he's trying to stifle the accent, his like mouth doesn't, and it's, can't quite.
It's almost like it's going for kind of an East Coast accent, but it doesn't work out. I don't know what it is. I'm just glad that he's, you know, for years now, he's really shed his the whole rom-com phase that he had gone through. Oh my gosh. I'm not saying that he was awful in it, but it's just like he's so much better at these types of movies. Like I haven't caught up with Den of Thieves yet, but they're making a sequel out of it, and I heard he was really good in that. But surprisingly, he has been really good in those like Olympus Has Fallen, London Has Fallen, and then like Angel Has Fallen. Now bear with me, those movies are pretty, you know, kind of, you know, generic action flicks, you know, but his character and he is really good in it. Surprisingly, especially this last one, Angel Has Fallen, and they're even going to make another movie with that character.
Standards Have Fallen.
Yeah, exactly. but he plays a character, I forget the guy's name, but probably something like Bannon or something, you know,
Rock Hardwell.
Yeah, exactly. but the highlight of that movie is his crusty father played by Nick Nolte.
My God.
So you got to see it just for that. I think it's on Netflix, but yeah, I mean, it is kind of fun to see him in these roles where, you know, the movie doesn't necessarily rely on him. He's an integral part of it, but you could tell he's, you know, when I said loose and fun about Carnahan, I think it's kind of loose and fun. Everybody's loose and fun in this movie. I mean, you know, the kind of the main character, you know, Alexis Lauder's character, she has less loose and fun to work with, but she opens, like I said, you know, having fun with twirling the gun and everything like that. But then, like, due to circumstances, you know, she has to, you know, take charge and get really serious. But everybody else is just, you could see the actors just like really just, you know, getting comfortable in their own characters and just, you know, being that kind of, you know, loose and fun, having that approach. It's good to see.
Even in the when she takes her more serious turn, particularly towards the end, right before she has the big confrontation with the film's, I guess, final antagonist, she has this kind of resigned sarcasm, you know, that really comes out, and it's very fun, but you can tell that she's just tired and she's just all out of F's to give.
Oh yeah, she's really thrown around really, a lot,
right? But it's just in her delivery, like she's like, oh, were you gonna come back for me after you finished that sandwich?
Right,
kind of a thing, right. You know, calling another character out on his nonsense,
right?
But and that's what keeps it fun, even in the darkest moments of this film. Not all of them, certainly, but a bunch of them, there's some humor. When one character dies by having his throat cut, he takes forever to die, but it's not played as a gag, it's played as, my God, that is a really horrible way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And the actor really, even though the actor has previously been sort of a darkly comedic relief,
yeah,
his death is very sincere, and you know, you can see him struggling with it. It's a great, I think, mixture of light and dark here, but it doesn't feel like the tone changes.
Yeah, and unfortunately, his death was, or his, let's say, what led up to his death was important, because it showed like how dangerous Butler's character is. You know, that was needed. He could have just, you know, headbutted him and knocked him out, but he went pretty far. And it is that whole, I like that whole setup of like, there's kind of this hallway in the jail room, and you know, there's one set of bars on one side and the other set of bars on the other side, and Teddy's on one side and, you know, Bob's on the other. And at first the camera's kind of prowling with them, you know, but it, this whole idea of like, it's almost like when, you know, in movies, you know, when two people are trapped and the real killer is, you know, is out, you know, and like, he's, get me out of here. Hey, give me a, hey, police, you know, somebody get me out of here. You know, this guy's dangerous. And, but, you know, they're in there because they're both, you know, they both had done something illegal and they're both potentially dangerous, but we get to see like who's more dangerous and who's the real threat. And so we're also trying to figure out, all right, who are we rooting for here? You know, so it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, especially because later on, when Officer Young is stuck in that room with them, she's in the direct middle.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the angel and devil on the shoulders. Like, right. which one am I going to listen to in this situation?
Yeah.
Or I have a feeling they both might be devils.
She needs help. Which one am I going to let out in order to help me? And then can I even trust them? You know? Yeah. So, yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, initially when Butler is apprehended, I mean, he's got no ID on him. They just list him as a John Doe. And, you know, eventually, you know, his true identity is revealed. But I like the way everything played out, you know, and the way that the characters were introduced. And especially the balloon assassin. I mean, that's just that guy. It's such an over-exaggerated, like, Southern accent and the, you know, the sense of humor. It's just,
well, it's and I'll close out on this because, you know, you could look at this movie and just from the outside say, I've seen this movie 100 times, and I've certainly said that about like recent movies, like full of cliches. But what I think Carnahan and company do here is they give us things that we've seen 100 times, but not necessarily in this way. We've seen the, you know, whether it's The Hitcher or Assault on Precinct 13, we've seen someone go into a, or The Terminator, we've seen someone go into a police station and murder lots of people. But with the introduction of the young, the Lamb character, sorry, with the balloons, that is, you know, it's realistic in that he doesn't just go on a killing spree. He, you know, knocks off a couple of people, but then other people like kind of wander into the room, or they're coming in through the main doors and he has to think quickly. The bodies pile up, but he doesn't, we're not even aware that he has that machine gun until after that scene, really.
Right.
And the same thing with the character that we haven't talked about yet, Huber, who is, again, he's a character we've seen before. He's in debt to some very bad people. He's sneaking into the evidence locker to like get drugs out or something. He's trying to do something. He's helping the bad guys against his, you know, comrades. But he sticks around a lot longer than I think
than you think would
in this movie. And he gets, you know, his just desserts, I think, in one of the greatest darkly comic moments of the film, where essentially, and I won't give it all away, but Gerard Butler's character gets a hold of his police belt, and it's like going through Batman's utility belt. I'm like, ooh, what does this do?
I have to say, and this may be morbid of me, but I really wanted that scene to go longer.
I did too.
It's just like, what's this? Let me use this. He's spraying him with the, he shoots the guy's knees and then sprays mace and stuff. Oh. It's like, yeah, it's just, I mean, I don't know what that says about me, but I just, because it's comical and, you know, the way Butler plays it out is just, it's fun.
But it's also inventive.
You know, it is. True.
I've seen people get shot in the legs or in the knees before. Mm-hmm. I've never seen them shot that many times and in that kind of specific pattern. So even though I'm watching kind of genre convention, if you can approach from a different angle, we're getting, you know, not even just like a literal camera angle, but from a different storytelling perspective, sure, it makes it entertaining and it keeps my interest. And this thing kept my interest for almost all of 2 hours.
Yeah. I mean, you could definitely tell that the writers were just kind of like, all right, yes, but how do we have fun with this?
Right. Why are we making this movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What can we do? Why should anyone care? Right.
What can we do a little different here? Because yes, this has probably been done before, but let's just tweak this a little bit. And I think they did a good job at doing that.
Definitely. Well, thanks for, you're the one who reached out and asked if I was going to watch this movie. I'm like, I think I'd scrolled right past it. It looks like, especially that poster, because you got the Grillo hair, it looks like a direct to video kind of collage, you know, poster, very generic looking. But once you like walk into the film and you experience it and you let it just be Cop Shop, I think people who are into this kind of thing are going to be really into this movie.
Yeah. It either looks like that, like a beaten up old VHS, or some, you know, comic you find in the dollar bin at a convention, you know, just like, what this is, you know, Frank Miller's runoff thing. What is this? You know, but yeah, it's a treat for those who like the genre, you know?
Yeah. And for those who, you know, I think is also a good gateway into the genre. If you, you know, like, I don't watch those kinds of movies, watch this one.
I would love to see that short by Alexis Lauder. I definitely am looking forward to more work from her.
Definitely. Like I said, I wasn't familiar with her, but I'm definitely going to look up her other stuff. And I feel like this is a star-making performance, assuming people see it.
Yeah.
when she blows up years from now, people are going to go back and be like, oh my God, she did this movie called Cop Shop. It's kind of like when Octavia Spencer shows up in Rob Zombie's Halloween 2 as a nurse.
I forgot about that. Yeah. No wonder she's in Ma. And I don't know who's going to rush out to see a movie like this in the theater. So I do think, in the world that we live in now, I think this is going to have better legs, you know, in streaming or, you know, Netflix, whatever, Amazon Prime. I think it's going to find a bit bigger audience, unfortunately, in home viewing.
Yeah. But, you know, that's as long as it finds an audience, I'm fine with that. But all right. Well, thank you again, sir. I'm taking up enough of your night, and I definitely appreciate it. And more Cop Shops, please. Not a sequel, because I don't want to see what happens. That
Cop Shop the musical. Oh
no, that'd be Cap Shop. Is that a reference to Hawkeye the trailer?
Could be.
Yeah, that's something I'm eager to talk about, because I was irrationally excited by the end of that Hawkeye trailer.
I'm surprised.
Yeah, well, there you go. But anyway, I will catch you later, sir, and have a great night.
All right, take care. Thanks.